This CLE is based on the appellate decisions released in November 2019 addressing civil procedure issues. The summaries of these decisions were initially posted in November 2019 on the New York Appellate Digest website, and they've since been compiled into the November 2019 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet. It's that pamphlet which serves as the written materials for this CLE, and the page references are to the pages in the pamphlet. The first case is Evans versus New York City Transit Authority on page 6. It deals with the prerequisites for a weight of the evidence review by an appellate court. It's out of the Second Department. And the Second Department, in issuing this decision, noted that it was disagreeing with the Third and Fourth Departments. Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Connolly, overruling precedent and disagreeing with the Third and Fourth Departments, held, one, a party need not make a motion to set aside the verdict to be entitled to an against-the-weight-of-the-evidence review by an appellate court. And two, the verdict finding the defendant bus driver in this case negligent, but also finding the negligence was not the proximate cause of plaintiff's slip and fall, was against the weight of the evidence. Plaintiff stepped into a pothole when getting off the bus, which had stopped to let her off after she had missed her stop. The court wrote, CPLR 4404A provides in pertinent part, after a trial of a cause of action or issue triable of right by a jury, upon the motion of any party or on its own initiative, the court may order a new trial of a cause of action or separable issue where the verdict is contrary to the weight of the evidence. Insofar as the trial court is permitted to order a new trial on its own initiative, that CPLR 4404A, and the power of the appellate division is as broad as that of the trial court, this court also possesses the power to order a new trial where the appellant made no motion for that relief in the trial court. That relief being the motion to set aside the verdict. The court went on, it was logically impossible for the jury to conclude that the bus driver was negligent in failing to provide the plaintiff with a safe location to alight from the bus, but that such negligence was not a proximate cause of the accident. It was uncontradicted that the plaintiff stepped directly from the bus into the pothole and immediately fell to the ground. Next is Ascari on pages 7 and 8. The issue addressed here is attorney-client privilege. Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Austin, reversing Supreme Court, held that New York law applied to a party's assertion of the attorney-client privilege for documents associated with a corporate acquisition and merger involving New York and Delaware business entities. The Second Department, disagreeing with Supreme Court, held that the choice of law was governed by public policy, and the proper theory for access to privileged documents is New York's law of replevin. In a nutshell, the Second Department held that the attorney-client privilege did not pass to the foreign corporation after the merger and acquisition, but rather remained with the New York parties and allowed the New York parties to pursue claims against the attorneys who represented them in the transaction. The court wrote, it would indeed be incongruous to enforce a law which effectively forecloses New York corporations merging with foreign corporations from having the ability to pursue their claims against their counsel or the newly formed post-merger entities based on the post-merger entities' control of the documents needed by the former entities to prosecute potential claims. Here, Delaware law gives the new corporation, a putative defendant, sole access to and control of the merger-related documents by exercise of the attorney-client privilege This is contrary to New York public policy. Next is Matter of Gonzales on page 8. It comes out of family court, and it deals with the issue of the withdrawal of an attorney from representing a client. Fourth Department, reversing family court, held the support magistrate's finding should not have been confirmed because the support magistrate allowed father's attorney to withdraw without notice to father and proceeded in father's absence. The court wrote, an attorney may withdraw his counsel of record only upon a showing of good and sufficient cause and upon reasonable notice to the client, and a purported withdrawal without proof that reasonable notice was given is ineffective. Next is Lubanti on page 9, Court of Appeals case dealing with tolling of the statute of limitations relating to a bankruptcy filing. Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Garcia over a three-judge dissent, held an automatic bankruptcy stay tolls the statute of limitations where a party has a pending action at the time the stay was imposed. In this case, the underlying actions were foreclosure filings. The court wrote, New York law tolls the statute of limitations where, quote, the commencement of an action has been stayed by a court or by statutory prohibition, end quote, citing CPLR 204A. Federal bankruptcy law automatically stays the commencement or continuation of any judicial proceedings against the debtor upon the filing of a bankruptcy petition, citing 11 U.S.C. section 362A. We must determine whether the bankruptcy stay qualifies as a statutory prohibition under CPLR 204A, and if so, whether a party may later avail itself of the toll where, at the time the stay was imposed, that party had a pending action asserting the same claim. We answer yes to both questions. Plaintiff argues that it's impossible for defendant to have been prohibited from commencing an action because a foreclosure action had been commenced prior to plaintiff's bankruptcy filing. Application of plaintiff's rule would be as follows. Because defendant filed the first foreclosure claim and plaintiff responded by filing a bankruptcy petition, invoking the automatic stay, commencement of that first action was not stayed under the statute and the toll is inapplicable. And when defendant filed a second foreclosure action, and the plaintiff again responded by again filing a bankruptcy petition that invoked the automatic stay, commencement of that second action was not stayed, once again making the toll inapplicable. So the court rejected that argument and held that the statute of limitations was tolled on this foreclosure proceeding. Next is Wilmington Savings Fund Society on page 10. It's another foreclosure action involving a bankruptcy filing. The Fourth Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Carney, held that the mortgage debt was not accelerated by a discharge in bankruptcy. Therefore, the statute of limitations was not triggered and an in rem foreclosure action remained viable. The court said, once a mortgage debt is accelerated, the entire amount is due, and the statute of limitations begins to run on the entire debt. Where the acceleration is made optional with the holder of the note and mortgage, some affirmative action must be taken evidencing the holder's election to take advantage of the accelerating provision. And until such action has been taken, the provision has no operation. Here, the mortgage provided plaintiff the option to accelerate the debt under certain circumstances, but did not state that the debt would be automatically accelerated if defendant obtained a discharge in bankruptcy. We reject defendant's contention that the discharge in bankruptcy automatically accelerated the debt and thus triggered the statute of limitations with respect to the entire debt. Even after the debtor's personal obligations have been extinguished by Chapter 7 discharge, the mortgage holder still retains a right to payment in the form of its right to the proceeds from the sale of the debtor's property. And a bankruptcy proceeding does not impair the mortgage holder's right to commence an action against the debtor in rem to seek payment from the proceeds of a foreclosure sale. Chapter 7 discharge removes the mode of enforcement against the debtor in personam, but the obligation otherwise remains intact and does not impact an action in rem. Next is the Deutsche Bank case on page 11, Court of Appeals case interpreting the borrowing statute. Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Fahey over a two-judge dissent, held that California, the residence of the plaintiff was a residential mortgage-backed securities trustee, the residence was where the breach of contract occurred, not New York. Therefore, pursuant to CPLR 202, New York's borrowing statute, the action must be timely under both California and New York law. The action was not timely under California law, which has a four-year statute for breach of contract. The court said, "We conclude that plaintiff's residence applies to determine the place of injury in this case. As trustee, plaintiff is authorized to enforce, on behalf of the certificate holders, the representations and warranties in the relevant agreements. Accordingly, it is appropriate for us to look to plaintiff's residence as the place where the economic injury was sustained, and consequently, where plaintiff's causes of action accrued for purposes of CPLR 202. Next is Burdick on page 12. It's a class action case, the Third Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Lynch, held that Supreme Court properly certified four classes to bring class action suits against a manufacturer alleging the contamination of water, air, real property, and people with toxic chemicals, those being PFOA and PFOS. The court wrote, "Plaintiffs, residents of the town, commenced this action as a proposed class action alleging that defendants' use and improper disposal of POFA and PFOS caused personal injury and property damage. In their complaint, plaintiffs proposed four classes. 1, a public water property damage class. 2, a private well water property damage class. 3, a private well nuisance class. And 4, a PFOA invasion injury class. Generally, the putative class members were individuals who owned or leased property in the town, or who ingested contaminated municipal or well water, or inhaled PFOA or PFOS particulates in the town, and had demonstrable evidence of elevated levels of chemical in their blood system. We agree with Supreme Court's determination that in addition to those questions common to the property classes, the answers to certain additional common questions will be applicable to all members of the invasion injury class. For example, 1, whether medical monitoring is an available remedy. 2, the extent of the health hazard presented by exposure to PFOA. And 3, whether the members of the class are at significant increased risk for disease based on the excess accumulation of PFOA in their bodies. Although defendant contends that there are a myriad factual questions that are not common to the class, we do not agree that those predominate. Importantly, this is not a case where there is an issue of fact regarding exposure. Rather, each class member must establish exposure and accumulation through blood work. Next is the Bozzio case on page 13. It's a putative class action case, and the issue is whether the statute of limitations was told by the filing of similar actions. Second Department held defendants' motion to dismiss these wage underpayment actions as time-barred to the extent they seek damages for underpayment more than 6 years before the suits were brought was properly denied. The Second Department held that pursuant to a Supreme Court case, American Pipe and Construction Company versus Utah, 414 U.S. 538, the statute of limitations was told based upon the filing of prior similar actions. The court wrote, "The plaintiff's home health aides, who were employed by the defendants, AmeriCare, and who often worked 24-hour live-in shifts, seek to recover damages for underpayment of minimum overtime and spread of hours wages in violation of the labor law and New York State Department of Labor wage orders and regulations. We find that applying American Pipe tolling under the circumstances where a court has not previously addressed the impropriety of class certification is consistent with the policies underlying the tolling doctrine, avoiding multiplicity of suits and vexatious litigation. Accordingly, we agree with the Supreme Court's denial of the defendant's motion to dismiss." So under the rationale of that Supreme Court case, American Pipe, 414 U.S. 438, the fact that similar actions had been filed before this putative class action was filed told the statute of limitations, allowing plaintiffs to seek damages for underpayment going back more than 6 years prior to the filing of the putative class action. Next is the Rivera case on pages 13 and 14. It has to do with disclosure of expert evidence. First Department held defendant's motion to preclude plaintiff from offering his expert's report and to turn over the materials relied upon by the expert was properly denied in this stairway slip and fall case. The court wrote, "Preclusion of expert evidence on the ground of failure to give timely disclosure, as called for in CPLR 3101, is generally unwarranted without a showing that the noncompliance was willful or prejudicial to the party seeking preclusion. Prejudice can be shown where the expert is testifying as to new theories or where the opposing side has no time to prepare a rebuttal. Here, plaintiff withheld information about an expert he retained and who performed a comprehensive inspection and report before the demand for expert disclosure was served, failed to disclose this in response to such demand, and continued to withhold such information over the course of many court conferences and the years that the case was pending. He offers no excuse for his delay or for having served a response to defendant's expert disclosure demand that was arguably misleading. However, when plaintiff eventually did disclose the expert, it was not on the eve of trial. His disclosure was made on or about March 9, 2018, about 6 weeks before the originally scheduled date of April 30, 2018, a lead time further expanded with the court's 60-day adjournment. Moreover, notwithstanding defendant's claims to the contrary, plaintiff's expert did not advance a theory of liability that was different from which plaintiff had previously advanced. Defendant also fails to show grounds to disturb the court's denial of its motion to direct plaintiff to turn over materials relied upon by his expert. Defendant claims it is entitled to these materials because, given the passage of time, any expert it would retain now would not be inspecting the premises that resemble the premises at the time of the accident. However, defendant does not adequately explain its failure to timely retain an expert of its own. Next is BEC Capital on page 14. It's a disclosure case dealing with trade secrets. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the discovery production of defendant's source code, a trade secret, should have been for attorneys and expert eyes only. The court wrote, "The production of defendant's source code, which is a trade secret, should have been ordered to be produced for, quote, attorneys and expert eyes only, end quote. Plaintiff's assertion that they have the expertise to review and opine on the source code and should not be subjected to retaining an expert does not support unfettered access to defendant's confidential algorithm." Next is MHB versus ECFS on page 15. It deals with the criteria for a motion to dismiss a complaint. First Department held defendant school's motion to dismiss the complaint was properly denied. Plaintiffs alleged the school retaliated against them after they complained about race-related issues by making a false child neglect report to Child Protective Services. The school argued the plaintiffs will not be able to learn the identity of the person who reported the alleged neglect because of the immunity provided by the social services law. The First Department explained that the immunity question was not relevant to whether the complaint states a cause of action. The court said, whether plaintiffs can ultimately establish their allegations is not part of the calculus in determining a motion to dismiss. Thus, regardless of whether plaintiffs will be able to obtain disclosure concerning the identity of the Child Protective Services reporter, that's Social Services Law Section 422, defendants have not demonstrated entitlement to dismissal of the well-pleaded complaint for failure to state a cause of action. Next is Bethpage Federal Credit Union on page 16. It deals with what kind of proof can be submitted in reply. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court in this foreclosure case, determined plaintiff bank did not submit sufficient proof of defendant's default, standing, or the amount owed, and the deficiencies could not be cured by a second affidavit submitted in reply. The court wrote, the plaintiff submitted the affidavit of its assistant vice president, Keith Weinkauf. As to the defendant's alleged default, Weinkauf stated that the defendants failed to make the full payment due on the maturity date of the note. On the issue of standing, Weinkauf averred that effective March 31, 2016, Montauk Credit Union merged into Bethpage Federal Credit Union. Further, with respect to the amount owed by the defendants, Weinkauf stated that the current unpaid principal balance due on the note was $58,165, plus interest, late charges, and fees. However, apart from producing a copy of the note itself, Weinkauf submitted no evidence in admissible form with his affidavit to establish the existence of a default, the plaintiff's standing, or the calculation of the unpaid amount owed by the defendants. Although the plaintiff later submitted with its reply papers a second affidavit from Weinkauf, along with supporting documentary evidence, to establish its standing, the plaintiff could not, under the circumstances presented, rely on the second affidavit to correct deficiencies inherent in the original one. Next is REMAX of New York on pages 16 and 17. It raises the issue of judicial estoppel. Second Department explained the nature of an admission and the doctrine of judicial estoppel in this action to determine whether defendant, named Weber, was a shareholder of the plaintiff, REMAX of New York. The court wrote, Weber's prior admissions made in other actions that he was not a shareholder of REMAX of New York did not constitute formal judicial admissions entitling REMAX of New York to summary judgment. Formal judicial admissions are facts admitted by a party's pleadings and are conclusive of the facts admitted in the action in which they are made. The admissions relied upon here were not made in this action. Furthermore, REMAX of New York failed to establish that the doctrine of judicial estoppel applies. Under the doctrine of judicial estoppel, also known as estoppel against inconsistent positions, a party may not take a position in a legal proceeding that is contrary to a position he or she took in a prior proceeding, simply because his or her interests have changed. The doctrine applies only where the party secured a judgment in his or her favor in the prior proceeding. This doctrine rests upon the principle that a litigant should not be permitted to lead a court to find a fact one way and then contend in another judicial proceeding that the same fact should be found otherwise. The doctrine is invoked to estop parties from adopting such contrary positions because the judicial system cannot tolerate this playing fast and loose with the courts. Here, since REMAX of New York failed to show that Weber secured any formal grant of relief in the other actions based upon his prior statements, they do not implicate the doctrine of inconsistent positions. Rather, the statements constitute informal judicial admissions that are not conclusive, but are merely evidence of the fact or facts admitted, the circumstances of which may be explained at trial. Next is Warren on pages 17 and 18. It has to do with jurisdiction and the tension between a workers' compensation claim and a negligence action based on the same events. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court and reinstating the negligence action, determined Supreme Court did not have jurisdiction over the matter because the Workers' Compensation Board had not yet ruled whether plaintiff was injured when acting in the scope of his employment. The court wrote, although not raised by the parties, we conclude that Supreme Court erred in entertaining defendant's motion. It is well settled that primary jurisdiction with respect to determinations as to the applicability of the workers' compensation law has been vested in the Workers' Compensation Board. It is therefore inappropriate for the courts to express views with respect thereto pending determination by the board. Whether plaintiff was injured within the scope of his employment must, in the first instance, be determined by the board, and the court thus should not have entertained defendant's motion at this juncture. Rather, the case should have been referred to the board for a determination of plaintiff's eligibility for workers' compensation benefits. Next is the Crosby case on page 18. It's another jurisdiction case, this time a divorce action. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held New York did not have jurisdiction over father, a Kentucky resident, in this divorce action. The couple had last lived in New York in 1995 and had resided in Kentucky from 2003 to 2015. The court wrote, assuming without deciding that the wife established one of the predicates for jurisdiction under CPLR 302B, we find that the quality and nature of the husband's activities in New York were such that it would be unreasonable and unfair to require him to defend an action in this state. Although the parties married in New York in 1991 and resided here until 1995, they have not resided together in this state for over 23 years. From 2003 until 2015, the parties resided together in Kentucky, where at the time of commencement of this action, the husband was employed as a university professor, and the parties owned real property. With the husband's consent, the wife moved to New York with the party's son in August 2015, and, as vaguely asserted by the wife, the husband has visited them in New York. The parties have not rented or purchased a home in New York. Rather, the wife and the son have lived rent-free with the wife's parents, with the husband providing additional financial support. In our view, the husband's contacts with New York are insufficient to warrant the exercise of personal jurisdiction over him. Accordingly, Supreme Court should have granted the husband's motion to dismiss the complaint for lack of personal jurisdiction. Next is Knight versus Acacia Network on page 19. It has to do with whether law office failure was an adequate excuse for a late response to summary judgment motions. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that law office failure was an adequate excuse for failing to timely respond to summary judgment motions. The court said, we disagree with the motion court that plaintiff failed to demonstrate both a reasonable excuse for her default and a meritorious cause of action. We find that the law office failure that resulted in plaintiff's two-week delay in filing opposition to defendant's motions was not willful and that a meritorious cause of action as to both incidents had been set forth. Next is Blatt versus Johar on pages 19 and 20. It deals with necessary parties. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the complaint should not have been dismissed for failure to join a necessary party because one, defendant, Accent, was not a necessary party, and two, even if Accent were a necessary party, the court should have summoned Accent itself pursuant to CPLR 1001B. The action concerned alleged defects in a house plaintiffs had purchased from defendants and claimed fraud, negligence, deceptive practices, breach of implied warranty, and breach of contract. Accent had constructed the house. The court wrote, Accent has no connection to the plaintiff's cause of action for breach of contract, which alleges only that the defendants breached their contract with the plaintiffs. As for the balance of the plaintiff's claims, Accent is, at best, a joint tortfeasor, with the plaintiffs having the option to proceed against any or all joint tortfeasors. We note that even if Accent was a necessary party, it appears to be subject to the jurisdiction of the court, and therefore the Supreme Court should have ordered it summoned, rather than granting that branch of the defendant's motion, which was to dismiss the complaint for failure to join a necessary party. And the ability to summon a necessary party is spelled out in CPLR 1001B. Next is Williston versus Jack Resnick and Sons on page 20. It deals with the sufficiency of pleading, false arrest, and malicious prosecution causes of action. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the complaint did not state causes of action for false arrest and malicious prosecution. The court said, a civilian defendant who merely furnishes information to law enforcement authorities, who are then free to exercise their own independent judgment as to whether an arrest will be made and criminal charges filed, will not be liable for false arrest or malicious prosecution. To be held liable for false arrest, the defendant must have affirmatively induced the officer to act, such as taking an active part in the arrest and procuring it to be made or showing active, officious, and undue zeal to the point where the officer is not acting of his or her own volition. Similarly, in order for a civilian defendant to be considered to have initiated the criminal proceeding so as to support a cause of action based on malicious prosecution, it must be shown that defendant played an active role in the prosecution, such as giving advice and encouragement or importuning the authorities to act. Merely giving false information to the authorities does not constitute initiation of the proceeding without an additional allegation or showing that at the time the information was provided, the defendant knew it to be false, yet still gave it to the police or district attorney. Here, the plaintiff's complaint and his affidavit in opposition to the motion merely alleged that the defendants provided false information to the police, and therefore did not establish that the plaintiff has a cause of action to recover damages for malicious prosecution or false arrest against the defendants. Next is the Haar case on pages 21 and 22. It's a Court of Appeals case dealing with whether a private right of action arises out of a statute. Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Stein, held that Public Health Law Section 230, Subdivision 11B, does not create a private right of action. Plaintiff surgeon provided medical care to four patients injured in an automobile accident and submitted claims for payment to the defendant insurer. The insurer fully or partially denied the claims and then filed complaints against the plaintiff with the Office of Professional Medical Conduct, OPMC, alleging insurance fraud. The OPMC declined to discipline plaintiff. Plaintiff then sued defendant insurer for bad faith and malicious reporting in violation of Public Health Law Section 230.11b. The Court of Appeals noted a split of authority in the First and Second Departments regarding whether a violation of this statute gives rise to a private right of action. The court wrote, we have consistently identified three essential factors to be considered in determining whether a private right of action can be fairly implied from the statutory text and legislative history. One, whether the plaintiff is one of the class for whose particular benefit the statute was enacted, 2, whether recognition of a private right of action would promote the legislative purpose, and 3, whether creation of such a right would be consistent with the legislative scheme. Critically, all three factors must be satisfied before an implied private right of action will be recognized. Applying these factors here, we conclude that the legislature did not intend to create a right of action under Public Health Law Section 230, Subdivision 11B. Next is Nation Star Mortgage on pages 22 and 23. It deals with the kind of proof that can be presented in reply. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the plaintiff bank, Aurora, did not provide sufficient proof of providing notice of default to defendants in this foreclosure action. The Second Department noted that the bank need not affirmatively prove compliance with the notice requirements of Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1304, because the issue was not raised in defendant's answer. The court also noted that evidence submitted in reply papers addressing matters raised for the first time in opposition to plaintiff's motion for summary judgment can be considered, but evidence submitted for the first time in reply papers addressing issues which were raised in the answer should not be considered. Next is HSBC Bank on pages 23 and 24. It deals with service of process. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined that defendant made a sufficient showing to warrant a hearing on whether she was served with the summons and complaint in this foreclosure action. The court wrote, although defendant did not deny having actual notice of the action, when the requirements for service of process have not been met, it is irrelevant that defendant may have actually received the documents. Service is only effective when it is made pursuant to the appropriate method authorized by the CPLR. Actual notice alone will not sustain the service or subject a person to the court's jurisdiction when there has not been compliance with prescribed conditions of service. Next is another HSBC Bank case on pages 24 and 25, another foreclosure action. This has to do with whether a foreclosure action which was dismissed serves to accelerate the mortgage and therefore starts the statute of limitations. Second Department held the prior foreclosure action, which was dismissed on the ground the bank did not demonstrate standing, did not serve to accelerate the mortgage debt. Therefore, the statute of limitations did not start running and the current foreclosure action is timely. The court wrote, the Supreme Court in 2009 determined that the defendant was entitled to dismissal of the complaint for lack of standing. Whereas here, the prior action is dismissed on the ground that the plaintiff lacks standing, the purported acceleration is a nullity and the statute of limitations does not begin to run at the time of the purported acceleration. Further, the record contains no evidence of either a written assignment or physical delivery of the underlying note to plaintiff prior to April 2009, so as to establish plaintiff's standing to commence the 2009 action. Thus, contrary to the defendant's contentions, the commencement of the 2009 action did not accelerate the mortgage debt, and the statute of limitations did not begin to run when the 2009 action was commenced. Next is Wells Fargo Bank on page 25. It's another foreclosure case involving proof of standing, this time involving proof of a lost note. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff bank did not demonstrate it had standing to bring the foreclosure action. The UCC's requirements for demonstrating ownership of a lost note were not met. The court wrote, the affidavit of possession of the original note, sworn to by a vice president of loan documentation for the plaintiff, does not contain any details of delivery of the note, except for the claim that it was delivered to the plaintiff sometime after its execution, and that the plaintiff had possession of the promissory note on or before the date that this action was commenced. The lost note affidavit did not provide any facts as to when the search for the note occurred, who conducted the search, or when or how the note was lost. Thus, it failed to sufficiently establish plaintiff's ownership of the note. The plaintiff failed to demonstrate its ownership of the lost note, citing UCC 3-804, or that it had standing as the lawful holder or assignee of the subject note on the date it commenced this action. Next is the Sutton Animal Hospital case on page 26. It has to do with an amendment of the complaint done by the judge sua sponte. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judge should not have sua sponte granted plaintiff leave to file a second amended complaint in the absence of a motion and a proposed pleading. The leave to amend was vacated. Next is Ippolito on pages 26 and 27. It deals with a motion to set aside the verdict. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the motion to set aside the verdict in this slip and fall case should have been granted. Although plaintiff's expert was properly qualified, his opinion that the defendant's improper installation of the sidewalk slash manhole caused the sidewalk height differential over which plaintiff tripped and fell was not supported by evidence in the record. At this point, I'll insert the verification code for the attorney affirmation. This is the November 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE, and the verification code is RECORD. Again, the verification code for this November 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE is RECORD. The final case is Mast versus DeSimone. It's on page 27. It's another motion to set aside the verdict. Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held that the failure to award damages for future pain and suffering and future economic loss in this back injury case was against the weight of the evidence. The motion to set aside those aspects of the verdict should have been granted. A new trial was ordered on those elements. The dissenters argued the future economic loss issue was abandoned on appeal. The court wrote, "The jury's failure to award any damages for future pain and suffering is contrary to a fair interpretation of the evidence and deviates materially from what would be reasonable compensation. Although the evidence at trial established that plaintiff was permitted to return to work with no restrictions, the evidence also established that the injury she sustained in the accident severely affected her ability to perform the same sorts of tasks she had performed with ease prior to the accident. Moreover, the party's experts agreed that the injury to plaintiff's lumbar spine was caused by the accident, and plaintiff presented uncontroverted medical testimony at trial establishing that she continues to experience pain as a result of the injury. We also agree with plaintiff that the jury's failure to award damages for future economic loss is against the weight of the evidence. We disagree with our dissenting colleagues that the contention was abandoned on appeal and conclude that plaintiff adequately raised the specific contention in her brief." That concludes the November 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE.